Skincare experts and dermatologists have often touted the benefits of indoor humidity as essential for healthy, glowing skin. But did you know dry air can start to harm your skin in as little as 30 minutes? For years, many people have relied on humidifiers for better skin, sleep, and overall wellness. But traditional models? Bulky, mold-prone, and difficult to maintain. That's where Canopy Humidifier comes in. Recommended by leading dermatologists, Canopy is a completely reimagined humidifier designed to elevate any space, offering the ultimate in skincare and wellness benefits. Canopy's clean moisture combats dryness, dullness, and fine lines while strengthening the skin's barrier and boosting the effectiveness of topical skincare products. With its sleek design, Canopy is the cleanest and easiest humidifier on the market. With its unique technology, cleaning is as easy as popping it in the dishwasher. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy humidifier purchase today with Canopy's filter subscription. Even better, use code PODCAST at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Your skin well, thank you.
Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of America. And welcome to our brand new season, Murder City. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Back. And this season, we're taking you to Chicago in the roaring 20s, an era of gangsters, jazz, flappers, bootleg booze, corrupt cops, and the ghosts those violent days left behind. We'll be telling the true story of the man who personified the era more than any other, Al Capone, a man who rose to the top spot of the criminal underworld when he was just 25 years old, ruling over a city filled with speakeasies, brothels, and gambling joints, and an army made up of assassins, gunmen, and dirty cops and city officials. But even with all his power, Capone was a man who lived in fear, haunted by a vengeful spirit that was determined to follow him to the grave. This is episode 3 of season 10, Torrio. John Torrio was 31 years old when he first came to Chicago to free his uncle by marriage, Big Jim Colosimo, from threats by Black Hand gangsters. But Torrio's service went beyond that. He was soon reorganizing and expanding Big Jim's vice rackets, and while they continued to thrive for a short time, trouble was on the way. Reform movements against open vice began gathering strength, and the Levee District, where most of Jim's operations were located, was the first to feel the pain. On the night of October 18, 1909, an evangelist named Gypsy Smith led 2,000 of his followers into the Red Light District. By the time they reached 22nd Street, more than 20,000 curious Chicagoans were marching with them. As vice workers looked on in stunned disbelief from behind closed doors, three Salvation Army bands struck up and the congregation joined Smith in singing hymns as they marched through the levee, knelt before the most notorious brothels, and prayed. Smith ended the protest with a prayer for all of the levee's, quote, fallen women. The immediate result of the protest, however, was not what Smith had in mind. Many of the young men in the parade crowd who might have never set foot in the levee stayed behind to sample the wares of the various houses of ill repute. Once the religious folks were gone, the party in the district really got going. Mina Everleigh wickedly told a newspaper reporter, quote, "We're glad of the business, of course, but I'm sorry to see so many nice young men coming down here for the first time." But the laughter didn't last. In 1910, white slavery itself was crippled, although not ended, by the passage of the Mann Act. The famous Everleigh Club was closed in 1911, and the reform movement dealt the final blow to Big Jim's sex trafficking ring. A young woman who'd been part of the ring defied death threats and publicity and exposed the system. While indictments were pending against the traffickers, she was hidden away for safekeeping, but not well enough. Two men came for her flashing Department of Justice credentials, and her body was found the next morning, shot to pieces. The case against Big Jim collapsed, but it was too late to salvage the operation. Even after the police raids on their brothel stalled out, Torrio wasn't optimistic about the future of the levee. He convinced Colosimo that the days of wide open vice were numbered and that they should plan for the future. And what prompted their next step was the thriving business for automobile sales. In just 5 years, the number of motor cars in America had increased tenfold, and one of the results of this was the Roadhouse, a standalone establishment for drinking, gambling, and women that was usually located in isolated rural areas that were outside the jurisdiction of most police forces. Torrio believed the scores of small towns outside of Chicago were perfect for expanding the vice business. Jim agreed, and they opened their first roadhouse in Burnham, a small town on the Illinois-Indiana border. The president of the unincorporated village at the time was 20-year-old John Patton, who'd been working in a local saloon since age 14. He proved a willing partner, and by the time the next reform wave swept over the levee, Torrio was ready. It was a massive civil welfare parade that was organized on September 29, 1912. This protest spurred grand jury indictments and complaints against property owners in the levee, followed by the padlocking of many of the district's resorts. But the vice operators fought back. A meeting was held at Colosimo's Cafe, and soon after, the levee workers donned their gaudiest clothes and scattered through Chicago's most respectable residential districts. The girls, with their hips swaying and their voices loud, walked into fancy restaurants, tried to book rooms in elegant hotels, rang doorbells, and generally made a nuisance of themselves. The authorities were forced to concede that a mass eviction from the levee would be a mistake, so they suspended the raids, temporarily at least. But the reformers fought just as hard, until finally in November 1912, Chicago put an end to segregated vice in the city. However, the levee didn't completely disappear. Many of the famous resorts of the area were bulldozed to make way for some railroad lines, but others remained and became the jazz clubs of the 1920s. In addition, new resorts opened in the suburbs and in other parts of the city, and some of the original spots also opened their doors again, now disguised as hotels, saloons, and cabarets. In Burnham, Torrio's first roadhouse was doing brisk business. It was open 24 hours a day with 90 girls working three shifts. It earned more than $9,000 a month, of which Torrio kept half. Representing his uncle, he next acquired the Speedway Inn and the Burnham Inn. The customers, primarily laborers in the area's steel mills and oil refineries, were a rough crowd, but they were free to spend their money. All the sporting houses stood just a few feet from the Indiana line, so the girls and their customers could easily avoid arrest by scurrying across the line in the event of a raid. But those raids rarely happened by surprise. Warnings about the cops came by way of a network of gas station attendants, short-order cooks, and a roadside produce stand, all of which lay along the route to Burnham. Other vice operators also set up under the protection of Burnham's young mayor until finally the small community, which measured barely a mile wide, was nothing but a cluster of buildings that offered booze, gambling, and prostitutes. Nobody did business there for long, though, without Torrio's consent. One night, a hoodlum named Dandy Joe Fogarty drunkenly threatened Torrio in the Burnham Inn and was found later with his body riddled with bullets. Two of Torrio's men, Sonny Dunn and Tommy Enright, were briefly detained by the county cops, but were soon let go. However, things were not going as well for Torrio and what was left of the levee. Several beat cops and their bosses, who'd been on Torrio and Big Jim's payroll, had been either arrested or fired, and Mayor Carter Harrison Jr. had set up a new moral squad to investigate and arrest vice offenders, independent of the Chicago police. Disturbed by the new appointments, the Levy vice bosses convened again at Colosimo's Cafe. They agreed that the moral squad must be stopped. If not with money, then with bullets. An attempt was made to bribe the head of the squad with $2,000 a month, but he arrested the man who made the offer for attempted bribery. Over the next few weeks, the Moral Squad arrested more than 2,000 vice operators and brought more charges against the regular police officers assigned to the levy. Enough was enough. And after a vote, a hit was put out on the top men in the Moral Squad, a threat that eventually reached the squad's commander, Inspector W.C. Dannenberg. A short time later, a sergeant from the Moral Squad was knifed to death. And then on July 16th, Dannenberg led a raid on a brothel when he and his men were confronted by an angry mob. Hoping to shake them, the squad walked toward Michigan Avenue, but the crowd followed, still shouting and now throwing rocks at the officers. Dannenberg, worried about how things were going, hurried and caught up with the patrol wagon that was taking the prostitutes that had been arrested downtown. The rest of the squad was left to walk, but they drew their revolvers in hopes that a threat of possible force might get the mob to back off. But it didn't work. Moments later, a red automobile appeared and parked near the back of the crowd. John Torrio and two thugs, Roxy Vanilli and Mac Fitzpatrick, got out. At the same time, two regular police sergeants, Stanley J. Burns and John C. Sloop, came around the corner from Michigan Avenue. Seeing guns and mistaking the Moral Squad guys for gunmen, they also drew their revolvers. By this time, Torrio's men had mixed in with the mob, and seconds later, shots rang out. Who fired the first shots and who they were aimed at has never been determined, but when the sound of gunfire faded, Sergeant Burns lay dead, and three of the Moral Squad men had been hit several times. That red car was gone. The authorities rounded up the usual suspects after the shooting, and for the first and last time in his life, Big Jim Colosimo was jailed on conspiracy charges. He spent a few hours in the police station lockup before being released on bail. No one was ever indicted, and the state's attorney closed the investigation for lack of evidence. Among Mayor Harrison's last acts in office was the transfer of some of the gangster's police cronies to precincts far from the levee, and he also canceled Big Jim's liquor license. But his cafe didn't stay closed for long. The mayoral election of 1915 brought a new Republican mayor into office, a man named William Big Bill Thompson, who was destined to become the hero of every pimp, whore, gambler, gangster, and bootlegger in Chicago. William Hill Thompson served as the mayor of Chicago during what was undoubtedly the city's most corrupt and violent period. When he finally left office after three terms, the Chicago Tribune wrote that Thompson's time in office, quote, gave the city an international reputation for moronic buffoonery, barbaric crime, triumphant hoodlumism, unchecked graft, and dejected citizenship. He nearly ruined the property and completely destroyed the pride of the city. In Thompson's defense, he served as mayor through the most challenging era in Windy City history. In those days, Chicago seemed to be filled with gangsters. Gangsters who slaughtered one another, like 214 dead in just 4 years. Gangsters killed by the police, 160 killed during that same period. Gangsters shooting up buildings, throwing bombs, and speeding in large automobiles and beer trucks. Gangsters with shotguns, rifles, and machine guns. Gangsters bribing city officials, ward bosses, and aldermen. Gangsters dining in expensive restaurants and attending plays, operas, and baseball games. Pretty much gangsters everywhere. Except in jail. Ah, that's all newspaper talk, scoffed Mayor Big Bill Thompson. But just for the record, according to the Illinois Crime Survey, Al Capone was one of the largest contributors to Thompson's mayoral campaigns, which leads most to believe that his ties to gangland were not just rumors. But how corrupt was Thompson? Did he purposely allow the criminal element of Chicago to run unchecked during his terms of office? Or was he just so inept that he had no idea of the lawlessness around him? Who can say? But we should note that when he first started his political career, one of his supporters stated, quote, "The worst thing you can say about him is that he's stupid." Thompson's early life was spent avoiding education. He went out west as a young man to become a cowboy, but returned to Chicago after his father's death. He later achieved a small amount of fame as the captain of the Chicago Athletic Club's water polo team, which was his only qualification for office when he ran the first time. He ran for alderman in 1900 after making a $50 poker bet with friends who said he was too afraid to run. His speeches were dull, his delivery was listless, and he had no idea what he was talking about. In fact, he was so clueless that when it was time for him to smile or laugh, a friend would drop a quarter on the floor as a signal. Thompson ran for mayor with the wide openness of a champion athlete on the side of truth, justice, and the American way. He actually vowed in his first campaign that, quote, "I'm going to clean up Chicago." But by his third campaign, his picture was hanging in Al Capone's office, and the gangster was donating as much as $250,000 for Thompson's reelection. After winning that first election, Chicago again became a city that was wide open for vice and crime. But criminals were not the only ones who put Thompson into office. People actually voted for him, although who they thought they were voting for is anyone's guess. During that initial run, every position in Thompson's platform invalidated some other position. What he said depended on where he was campaigning. In German neighborhoods, newspapers said that he sounded like Kaiser Bill, and he later generated a lot of controversy when he refused to invite French officials to Chicago during a national tour to drum up American support for their side in the Great War. Thompson noted that Chicago was the sixth largest German city in the world and added that he didn't think many residents would be interested in having the Frenchmen there. In the German-hating Polish neighborhoods, his campaign workers passed out flyers that called his opponent the German candidate. In Protestant neighborhoods, a vote for the opponent was a vote for the Pope. In the Irish wards, he lashed out at the English, and when addressing American audiences, he wrapped himself in the flag and claimed to model himself after George Washington. He promised the reform group strict enforcement of the anti-gambling laws, and he promised the gamblers a wide-open town. To wives and mothers of the upper-class neighborhoods, he swore to clean up the city and drive out the crooks, making Chicago the cleanest city in the world. He told the anti-saloon groups that he would enforce the state's blue law and continue prohibiting liquor sales on Sunday. But he promised the wets that he would oppose all Sunday blue laws, and he won over the saloon owners by signing a pledge to that effect. "I see no harm in a friendly little drink in a friendly little saloon," he said. It was not a surprise when Big Bill Thompson won the 1915 mayoral election with the largest vote ever registered for a Republican in Chicago. Within 6 months, he had violated every campaign promise he made, except for one. He did keep Chicago a wide-open town. After a few token arrests on the levee and elsewhere, a new live-and-let-live policy began to prevail. Slot machines rang bells and dumped out coins all over the city, with politicians at City Hall getting a cut of the profits. The Sportsman's Club, a Republican organization, was used as a collection agency for graft. Membership in the club swelled after gamblers, gangsters, brothel keepers, and saloon owners received a letter on club letterhead bearing Thompson's name that offered $100 lifetime memberships. Big Jim became one of the new members right after Thompson restored his liquor license. Instead of the large, easily raided whorehouses that once operated, vice owners had started maintaining numerous discreet call flats. The prostitutes would seek out their customers in dance halls and then take them to the flats. Trying to expose this new scheme, the Moral Squad published a report that estimated the number of call flats in Chicago at 30,000. Soon after, Mayor Thompson stripped the Moral Squad of all its authority. The first 8 months of Thompson's time in office produced twice as many complaints about the police as the entire preceding year. Police Chief Healy, who had begun his tenure with a declaration of war against the underworld, ended it by being exposed as the boss of the city's largest graft ring and on intimate terms with some of the most notorious gangsters in the city. In January 1917, he was even indicted on bribery charges, along with three other members of his department, an alderman, and four underworld vice operators. As the main exhibit during the trial, the prosecution produced a notebook confiscated from a Northside police lieutenant. The first pages listed shady hotels and their weekly payoffs of between $40 and $150. Next came sporting houses and gambling dens, and named the saloons the police allowed to operate illegally after 1 a.m. and on Sundays. There were also lists of gambling and disorderly houses that were headed "can't be raided" or "can be raided," as long as an appropriate warning was given, of course. Healy retained two of Chicago's most successful criminal attorneys for his defense, Charles Erbstein and Clarence Darrow. Despite all the evidence against him, they got him acquitted. Soon after, City Alderman Charles E. Merriman wrote, "Chicago is unique. It is the only completely corrupt city in America." John Torrio watched the rise of Big Bill Thompson with great interest. He knew the time was coming for even bigger money to be made in the Chicago underworld, and knew that the loose enforcement of laws under the new mayor would make that possible. But Torrio was already making a lot of money, despite his unusual way of doing business. He catered to the vices of others, although he seemed to have none. He never smoked, drank, or gambled, and took no interest in any woman but his wife, Anne. He kept a daily routine, leaving home in the morning and either walking to his office on South Wabash or driving to Burnham. He spent 9 or 10 hours attending to the details of the business, which meant moving girls from house to house to make sure that customers saw fresh faces, purchasing food, drink, and linens, and calculating the profits from the night before. If he didn't encounter any problems that needed to be dealt with, he returned home each night by 6 p.m. and had dinner with his wife. Unless they attended an occasional play or a concert together, he stayed home until morning. He had no interest in nightlife. He and Anne played cards or listened to records. Torrio loved music and knew a lot about it. He could follow a score and hold a conversation with a professional musician. Anne once said, quote, "He is the best and dearest of husbands. My married life has been like one long unclouded honeymoon. He has done everything to make me happy. He has given me his wholehearted devotion. I've had love, home, and contentment." Torrio was a family man, devoted husband, quiet and contented businessman, and one of the coldest and most calculating gangsters in Chicago history. He routinely ordered the deaths of rivals, thought nothing of directing beatings, bombings, and shootings, and felt no sympathy for the prostitutes he employed. He regarded them simply as commodities to be bought, sold, and replaced when time ran out. Crime was just business to Torrio, and in his case, crime definitely paid. Torrio was a skilled business manager for Big Jim, turning him into Chicago's top vice lord through hard work and the lax state of affairs under the Thompson administration. Jim's political value extended far beyond the levee, and with his city hall connections, he no longer depended on the ward politicians for protection. In fact, they came to him for favors. The cafe was Colosimo's pride and joy, perhaps even his obsession. He dealt with all the minutiae of running the restaurant and was happiest there, fussing over customers and celebrities and being flattered and admired by them in return. He gave complete authority to Torrio when it came to all of his other business dealings, which was his first serious mistake. His second mistake was a romantic one. One evening in 1913, Jack Lade, a reporter from the Chicago Daily News, came in to Colosimo's and began telling him about a girl he'd heard singing in the choir at the South Park Avenue Methodist Church. Jack Lade told him that the girl was talented and a knockout, and he thought she deserved a better place to showcase her talents. Maybe she could sing in the cafe. Big Jim agreed to give the girl an audition, and the following evening, Lade introduced him to Dale Winter, a, quote, slender, demure brunette with blue eyes and skin like rose petals. Dale was only 19 years old. She'd been born in Ohio and dreamed of a career in opera. Her father died when she was only 5, and her mother took her to New York after high school. She auditioned for a producer and was casting a road company version of an operetta called Madame Cherie, which had been a smash hit. Fittingly, Dale won the part of an innocent young girl. Chaperoned by her mother, she traveled across the country to San Francisco, where the tour ended. Hoping to stay on the road, she put together a vaudeville sketch with another actress, sold it to a company that was about to depart for Australia, and went along to play the main part. In Australia, though, the venture collapsed, stranding Dale and her mother 6,000 miles from home. Luckily, they borrowed money from a sympathetic actor and made their way back to San Francisco. A booking agent then sent them to Chicago, where he assured them Dale could find work with a newly organized light opera company. Unfortunately, when they arrived, they found the company had disbanded without staging a single performance. The two women were penniless, but the South Park Avenue Methodist Church kept them from starving when they hired Dale as a singer. Big Jim found that Dale was everything his reporter pal had promised. He immediately hired her for his stage show, and she soon became his star attraction, enchanting the customers every night. She was soon making more money than she'd ever dreamed, but Dale didn't want to leave the church choir. She continued to sing hymns by day until the congregation discovered she was working at Colosimo's at night. They were scandalized and demanded her immediate dismissal. The church pastor was more tolerant and chose as a theme for his following sermon the Bible passage from John 8 that reads, quote, "He that is without sin among you, let him cast the first stone." But his defense didn't move the parishioners, and fearing for his own job, he had no choice but to let Dale go. Dale was upset by the congregation's anger. She'd been trying to do the right thing. She was working at the nightclub to survive. She promised herself she would quit as soon as she'd saved enough money to get herself and her mother back to New York. And thanks to rave reviews, other job opportunities were already coming her way. The Broadway impresario Morris Guest had offered her a contract, as did the famous Florin Ziegfeld. But Dale had been dragging her feet and soon didn't want to leave Chicago at all. She had fallen in love with Big Jim Colosimo, and he had fallen in love with her. In fact, Big Jim left his wife, and he told Torrio that his love for Dale was the real thing. "Well, it's your funeral," Torrio replied, which would turn out to be prophetic words. With Dale's gentle guidance, Jim began to acquire a little polish. He learned to moderate his loud, overbearing voice and clean up his language. He hired a tutor to help him perfect his English. He began to dress more conservatively, leaving the diamonds at home. He began spending more time with artists and his wealthy customers, neglecting the politicians and underworld characters with whom he usually spent his time. Dale liked to ride horses in the city parks, and Colosimo, decked out in equestrian gear, would trot along beside her. He badgered his friend Enrico Caruso for an opinion about Dale's voice, and when the great tenor found it pleasing, Jim pressed for an audition with Chicago's famous opera company. The conductor also liked her voice, but found it needed training, so Colosimo enrolled her at the Chicago Musical College. Big Jim was happier than he'd ever been in his life, but little did he know at the time, his life was almost at an end. It's ironic that Dale, the only decent girl Jim ever knew, would be the reason for his death. You see, word had started to spread about Jim and his new girlfriend. He'd gotten soft, everyone said. Black Hand extortionists resumed their demands, and now Colosimo paid them off out of fear that something might happen to Dale. He never told Torrio that he was again under threat. He was too embarrassed. As for Torrio, while continuing to handle his uncle's business interests, he was also slowly and quietly building an organization of his own. He made plans to expand his vice operation beyond Burnham and found that officials in Stickney, a small village about 8 miles from the city, were open to his offers. Torrio also set up his own headquarters about a block from Jim's cafe. It was a four-story brick building at 2222 South Wabash Avenue that became known as the Four Deuces. On the first floor, he opened a bar and office. The second and third floors were used as gambling rooms, and the fourth floor was a brothel. It was the cellar, though, that became infamous. When Torrio had people he needed information from, they were taken down to that cellar and tortured until they talked. Those who didn't or didn't survive their interrogations were hauled out through a trap door at the back of the building, and their corpses were then dumped along a country road or dropped into a rock quarry. It's probably not a surprise to learn that the Four Deuces was later considered haunted. The resident ghosts could be traced back to the days when it was under mob control and also possibly to a horrific incident that occurred there long after the gangsters were gone. The building that would gain a reputation as the Four Deuces had been built around 1880. It held four apartments, one on each floor. In 1901, the building was purchased by the Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance Company during a foreclosure auction. They sold it to Solomon Friedman, who opened a saloon on the main floor, joining the dozens of other saloons already operating in the Levee District. Several unsavory establishments opened nearby offering gambling and prostitution, and Saul Van Praagh, a First Ward politician who also dabbled in gambling, opened a cigar store next door, which he used as a front for various operations. The place was often raided, including one night in 1917 when 17 people were arrested at an illegal craps game. Van Praagh eventually rented the place to Martin Guilfoyle, who shot and killed a hooligan named Peter Gentleman in the store in 1919. Soon after, Torrio took over the entire building and began offering drinking, gambling, and prostitution. As mentioned, he used it as his headquarters, and the basement became a place where rival gangsters were forced to give up information and sometimes give up their lives. After repeated raids on the property during a time when a reform mayor held office in the city, the Torrio Capone outfit moved their operations to Cicero, and the Four Deuces was closed. It was later turned into an apartment building again and became a scene of horror once more in 1932. On April 9th, a woman who lived in an apartment upstairs decided to end her life by filling her bathtub with kerosene, climbing in, and setting herself on fire. The building was torn down in the spring of 1964, but that didn't put an end to the rumors that still swirled around the neighborhood. According to former tenants, during the last decades of the building's existence, the place was haunted by ghosts from the past. Stories claim that screams and moans and cries and wails could often be heard coming from the basement, where gangsters had once met violent ends. Another story claimed that a screaming woman was sometimes heard in the third floor apartment. According to a witness who lived there, he once heard a blood-curdling scream echoing from his bathroom. When he dared to take a look, he found the room empty, but swore the smell of burning flesh was still in the air. He told a reporter, quote, "I served in France during the war. I know what death smells like, and that was in the air of that room." That bathroom was the same one in which the former tenant set herself on fire in 1932. Around the same time that Torrio organized his headquarters at the Four Deuces, he sent word back east to Brooklyn and invited his young friend Al Capone to come to Chicago. He wanted a man he could trust at his side. Torrio knew that things were just about to change in Chicago and all over America. Soon after Capone arrived, that momentous change occurred. It was something that Torrio had been planning for, had been trying, without much success, to get Big Jim to exploit. The profits created by this event, Torrio was convinced, would be many times more than anything they'd ever made with their vice operations. Big Jim, well, was not convinced. Gambling and vice had made him a fortune, so why risk the unknown? That was when Torrio finally had to accept that Colosimo's days were over. It was a new era for American crime, and John Torrio planned to take advantage of it. Prohibition had become the law of the land, and America had just run dry. Thanks for listening to this episode of American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming up right after these messages from our sponsors.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. We're taking a moment to celebrate women and all that they carry at work, in relationships, in families, and in the many roles they hold every day. Women have played a strong role in my life. I was raised by a single mother. She worked multiple jobs at once, and I can't imagine how difficult I was to deal with as a child. But somehow, my mom and a village made it work. I'm sure some of our listeners can also think of someone like that in their own lives. Often the strongest people in our lives are usually the ones holding everything together, which also means they are the last ones to get support themselves, or who might need someone to talk to the most. And that's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp has quality therapists who work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12 plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right the first time. And if you're not happy with your match, you can switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. They also have great client reviews. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy program, having served over 6 million people globally, and it works, with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Your emotional well-being matters. Find support and feel lighter in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
We all are buying supplements, taking vitamins, and following the latest workout trends. But what if the newest tip from your favorite health influencer isn't actually what your body needs? True Diagnostic helps you find out the exact supplements and lifestyle changes that can make a difference and which ones might just be wasting your money. If you're spending money on supplements, workouts, and wellness trends, it's worth knowing what is actually moving the needle for you. That's where True Diagnostic comes in. My at-home test was simple. The instructions were clear and easy to follow, and it came with a prepaid envelope, which made it convenient to send back because I don't have any stamps. I'm super stoked to receive my results in the next 2 to 4 weeks so I can dial in exactly what needs to be changed to improve longevity and health markers. Because I have plans for this podcast, so I gotta be in tip-top shape, and True Diagnostic is helping me get started. One of the tests True Diagnostic offers that I've taken is called True Health, which measures your current health. It tests over 105 biomarkers, including vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and fatty acids to understand systems' health right now. It focuses on energy, metabolism, inflammation, and nutrient status today. And it provides your top three health actions for the next 90 days. You can get even more info if you opt in for the combo kit, which includes the True Health test and the True Age test, which reports on longevity and aging. The experience and process is so simple that even Troy and I were able to figure it out. You order online and the kit ships right to your door. It's a quick single finger prick at home, then you drop it in the prepaid return package. You can get digital results with an easy to follow 90-day plan in your inbox. Your only job, follow the three most important actions you can take for 90 days, then retest to see your progress. You can get a one-time kit just to get a baseline of where your body's at currently, or a subscription to measure progress over time. Also, True Diagnostic is trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. Right now, our listeners can get 20% off at TrueDiagnostic.com using code HAUNTINGS at checkout. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code HAUNTINGS for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the Combo Kit as a one-time purchase or subscription.
Ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? Well, we're back with the postmortem, the part of the show after the show, where we sharpen our knives and dissect the episode. My name's Troy Taylor. I'm the guy who narrates and writes the show. And across from me is the guy who is my friend, my co-host, my partner in crime, Cody the Nose Back.
Yes, the Nose Nose. Yes,
we're sticking with that one.
We're sticking with it. I love it.
Yeah, I think that's the one.
So. Yeah, Nose is a little stuffier now.
I know you're not feeling well.
Yeah, you know, stuff's going around and just... you know, I can never tell when it's like that time of the year. Like I usually think it's the winter, but I think it's more when the seasons start to change a little bit.
We've had a lot of changeable weather lately. Yeah. So I mean, it was on last Friday. It was like 75.
I know.
So,
and now it's like 32.
Sunday it was 40. Yeah. You know. So you know, and rainy.
And the rain. I think the rain also.
The rain does not help.
It does something to stir up some kind of. I don't. Although maybe it is all the allergens and stuff. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, it could be.
That gets stirred up. But yeah, the nose knows. Other than that, doing well. We're rocking and rolling with the podcast network. A bunch of shows. A bunch of events. I'm waiting for you to put out a new book. I'm guessing because usually I feel like it's every other week.
Yeah, I know. I've been a little behind because of all the. Moving the museum, that was a lot of work. And then I've been traveling quite a bit. So
you got a lot going on.
I do have one that's getting closer to wrapping up. So we'll talk more about it soon.
I'm excited.
As far as other things we have coming up, this Saturday, March the 7th is the second anniversary at the American Oddities Museum. So we're hoping people will come and check out the new space and our new displays and our much larger bookstore and gift shop that day. It's a celebrate with us, you know. I'll be there signing books all day, plus the first 100 people who come that day will get a free American Oddities Museum pint glass.
That's which amazing.
They're pretty cool. They're pretty cool glasses.
It's only the second anniversary, and already moved that thing. Like,
I know we've already moved once. Yeah, right before our second year.
I do love this. I do love the new
start
space.
Of our third, whatever. Yeah, no, me too. Yeah. Me too.
I drive by all the time because I'm in Alton frequently, and I'm always looking to see if I can see you or somebody through the glass sometimes as I'm passing real quick. But it looks great. I like the setup. It's just a lot. It's more free flowing space, I think.
It is.
So it's pretty cool.
It is. So, and we've got some stuff. I just want to mention a couple of things we have coming up because they're coming up before we'll have another episode of the podcast. We've got a dinner event on Friday the 13th, March 13th. I'm doing In a Dark Place, the one about sinister hauntings and poltergeists and possessions and stuff. It's not the St. Louis Exorcism.
Okay, finally
when I get to leave that out, just because it's got its own deal. I've got that coming up on the 13th, and that's, I'm going to be adding in some new things that have never been heard before. It's some stuff that's going to be, I mean, I think I already spilled the beans that's the subject of my next book are these sinister hauntings and things.
Yes.
So I've got some new stuff I'm going to be adding for that. And then the next night, which is the 14th, I have a Ghosts of the River Road tour. That's our first dinner tour that we put together a few years ago. I'm still doing it. Still our most popular tour. And that's the one that starts at the museum. Then we'll have dinner and then we'll head up the river road. So yeah, that's what's coming up. You can check that out and see everything else we've got coming in March and April and May and June on the website at dinnerandspirits.com. Plus, again, I'm going to stress, I had a lot of people who responded to the pressure we put on them about the Haunted America Conference, which is good. We still have, you know, plenty of general admission tickets, but more of the after hours tours and ghost hunts and workshops have filled up. So if you really, if you're wanting to do any of those extra events, you got to get registered, man. You're going to run out of time. Just don't wait any longer. Go to ghostconference.net and get signed up. All right.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. Well, I wanted to give a quick shout out to our new supporters on Patreon. So thank you very much for subscribing to the show, to Sabrina, Lolly, and Kirsten. We really appreciate your support, and I hope that you're enjoying, depending on where you are in Patreon, right. I hope you're enjoying.
Depending on which podcast season you're listening to, some are a little more tolerable than others, but we are in the middle of our sixth season. Actually, we're not in the middle. We are almost at the very end of the sixth season. In fact, the next episode is going to be the end of the trial as we get into the Starved Rock murders of 1960. And soon we'll be delving into all the conspiracies and the all the crazy stuff that came after the trial, as if the murders weren't bad enough. So we'll get into all that other stuff and ghost stories and all of it here very soon. This is a show that this alternative podcast I'm talking about here, and you're thinking, wait a minute, did I miss this? Yeah, you did, if you're not a Patreon supporter. That's the only way you can get it. I offer it every other week, and you can get that along with special discounts and shirts and advanced sales and all kinds of stuff as a Patreon supporter. And you can become one for as little as $5 a month and still get the podcast. Mm-hmm. All you got to do is go to patreon.com/American Hauntings and get signed up. The anniversary of those murders is coming up in like a week and a half. It's March 14th. So since 1960 when it happened, but, It's still an ongoing controversy. So anyway, it's been a fun season to work on.
So. And it is, now that it is March, I'm going to owe some people some t-shirts too. So I'll get on that here shortly. And if I recall, March 14th, you know, a famous day in history for a lot of reasons, but also speaking of something we were talking about earlier, I remember this weird day in 2020, March 14th. That's when I was told, hey, you're not coming into work anymore.
I know.
It just be
I know. We're
weeks.
Almost there. It'll be 6 years since everything shut down. I know we've talked about it before, but I remember being in Chicago the week before that. And, you know, there were already rumors about Seattle and stuff. And I remember going with some friends of mine down to Chinatown to eat. And normally the place that that we went to would have this long wait. Was nobody there because people were freaking out, you know, that they, you know, had come from China and all this stuff. So, yeah, we did a tour that weekend. And then the next weekend had one more, you know, where we just like wiped down everything on the bus. Thinking we didn't know what else to do. And then next thing you know, it's closed and remained that way for quite some time. Still the weirdest period in my life.
Such a strange thing to live through in a lot of people's lives.
Yeah, it was a really strange thing to live through.
Probably a weirder thing to die through, but hell.
You know? I would definitely say that would be the case. So.
Oh, man. Well, I'd love to move on to something nicer, but I don't have any listener reviews because we're starting to get caught up. If people do like to leave reviews on, especially on Apple iTunes, it does help people find the show. And if we read your review on the show, then Troy will send you something cool in the mail. So if you
and
like
yes, I'm still working on that. But it is coming. I'm just going to keep saying it. Things are coming. So I actually just got some new stuff that came in because we had run out of like everything while the museum was closed. So that is my excuse for the delay.
Sticking to it.
Yes, I'm gonna stick with that.
Well, it's not funny, Troy, but it is like I open up my personal email inbox like so infrequently now because I pretty much live and die with work, you know. But as I open it up to do outlines and stuff for the show, I have 251 emails right now.
Oh my God.
Which is just not, it's not a feasible number. Most of them are not important. There's McDonald's receipts and things in here. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I'll you tell, still got to go through it, but
you still got to go through it. So I we're know. Trying everybody. We're just, we're two men trying to live our lives and just make it happen.
Yeah. We're getting there. We're doing all right.
We're getting there, but are you
hey,
ready?
The episodes are out. Let's yeah. Let's go with that. That's the main thing.
There you go.
We're
yes.
staying consistent. So
yes. Well, are you ready to dive into this?
Sure.
Episode?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm ready if you're ready.
So this man, John Torrio, it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
More you went on about him, the more interested I became.
Yeah, because I mean, up to this point, I think I had just talked about how he was this organizational genius
at 31?
Gave birth to modern, you know, modern crime, modern organized crime.
Right.
Because he was organized, which is,
because he was organized and right. 31 the first time he goes to Chicago, but then you do start to hear you started to teach me more about him, and it is very much like if you wanted to be probably the best of the best at this sort of thing, you probably would have to not be involved in the drinking and the this and the that and
right. Yeah, not everybody followed that, look what happened to most of them, you know,
exactly.
And, you know, not everything works out great for Torrio, but on the other hand, he's still standing at the end of our story, he's still alive. So, you know, that's right there is a big accomplishment back in those days for organized crime.
Yes. And I mean, because you talked about, I'm going to bounce around a little bit here, but
yeah,
I think
sure.
it helps that. Just these were some of the most corrupt and violent years in the city.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was the beginning of them for
the
sure.
The beginning of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, everybody thinks that just the roaring 20s were super violent, but it started before that because, mm-hmm. you know, the mob had to make its money, it had to build up its organization and things prior to Prohibition.
Right.
And so Torrio is, you know, taking all of the stuff that his uncle set up
mm-hmm.
and is essentially just sort of fine tuning it to make it better.
Yeah.
While also setting up his own organization, you know, maybe dabbling in some things that, you know, Big Jim didn't tell him he couldn't do, you know, didn't say not to do it. So
yeah.
he decided that he would, you know,
yeah, it's, yeah,
and, you know, he's got some initiative there and, He's setting up kind of his own organization to kind of go hand in hand with his uncle's while also still keeping his uncle, you know, probably the wealthiest that he's ever been.
Right. Right. And I mean, things are clearly changing in the Levee District.
Yeah.
And I mean, you talk about some marches in the street and then some people staying behind and it's the first time that they've ever been there. And
yeah.
Like the
that sort of backfired.
Yeah. Right.
You know, which is, you know, is humorous.
I mean,
I don't know. Should it be? Probably not, because, you know, we're talking about it. And I do try to expose that part of it, too. Well, yes, that's kind of funny. It's also, and you know, and while I had some, I do have, I'm not going to lie, some admiration for, Ada and Minna Everly, mm-hmm, with the club that they set up and, you know, it was different than in the stuff that, like, say, Torrio and Colosimo were doing, because mm-hmm. they're essentially, you know, sex trafficking. They're bringing in women that, you know, don't want to be in the business, where the Everly sisters are, you know, have girls who want to be in the business. They're well treated, they're well paid,
mm-hmm.
and they're providing an experience which was completely legal
right.
at the time. You know, whenever they would get raided for any reason, it would always be for some trumped up thing.
Sure.
And usually the Everlys didn't get raided very often. It would always end up being, I mean, they knew too many people and they were on the good sides of most people. And so they were able to hang on longer than most. And, you know, like I said, I've written an entire book about the vice districts in Chicago.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of ins and outs to all that as to what happened that they finally got closed down. Essentially, they I'll give it to you in a nutshell because it really doesn't fit in with the rest of the stuff. But there had been a book that was published that was like a guidebook to the red light districts in Chicago.
Really?
And it was sent out all over the country. And so businessmen and guys coming to town for conventions and stuff had these guidebooks. And eventually it got onto the desk of the mayor. And he was livid because this is not, this was not the the image of the city that he wanted. So all these people with their marches and their prayers and their singing and stuff, that didn't do anything. I mean, that really did nothing. What really did the trick was somebody, you know, going to the mayor and going, "Hey man, have you seen this?" Yeah. And him going, "Oh my God." And that, that's really what closed this stuff down. And, you know, I mean, he started the moral squad and all that stuff, which that in itself right there, you just, you don't, you want to dislike them because they're, you know, putting their morals on everybody else kind of thing. And so you're kind of like, okay, yeah, get these guys, you know,
the branding on that is just,
is terrible. Bad. Yeah. Although, I mean, I'm sure it looked good at the time. Of course. Mean, it was the right thing to do. It was the proper thing. It looked good in the newspapers, you know, and these guys had, you know, a decent amount of, you know, of power. But I mean, how much power, though, it's hard to say, because, you know, the standard beat cops, you know, who work the district and stuff, they don't care.
No,
they could have cared less. They the only time they were raiding anybody is when they were told they had to. And they usually call them hours in advance and go, "Hey, listen, you know, we got to come by tonight and, you know, break a couple of things and make a big deal out of it, because there might be a reporter along." You know, I mean, that's how things were working in those days. You know, but there was still a lot of pressure. You know, there was pressure on, you know, on everybody. You know, it looked bad to the with the brothels. It looked bad to the vice guys. And, you know, and then after the shooting at the, you know, after the, you know, the raids on the house, and then there was a shooting that killed. Yeah, that it killed a couple of guys. That's, you know, it looked bad.
It does look bad. It's something very interesting where there has to be a balance in this situation to maintain the city, I guess, because so much money is coming from illegal activity.
Well,
so much money is coming from legal activity and everything.
And the other thing was, is that because this stuff, because a segregated vice district was legal at the time and was making a lot of money, these guys were paying taxes.
Yeah.
I mean, these were, as bad as it sounds, and we don't have them now, these were legitimate businesses at the time.
Right.
And so they're paying a lot of taxes. And, you know, when they just said, "Oh, we can't just close everything," that's not feasible. But it became feasible. Eventually it became feasible and they shut things down.
Yes.
And so, you know, after that stuff just kept operating, because obviously it did, as we're just about to discuss, because we're going to have a new mayor here very soon.
Yes.
Our new mayor, you know, allows this stuff to happen and the money starts flowing into City Hall again, except nobody's paying taxes this time around. They're just putting it right in the pockets of the politicians.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, when you're, I'm not going to say what I was about to say. We're going to stay on.
Yeah, don't get yourself in trouble.
You know, we're going to stay on the island here and not get into all that.
So William Big Bill Thompson's elected mayor in 1951. Is this where we started to get the Windy City?
That started with, I mean, I could see where you would think that, but it started with the World's Fair.
The Windy City
thing was something that William Dana, who was the editor of a New York paper at the time, told the board that was going to choose what city would have the fair in 1893 to ignore all the boasting from that Windy City on Michigan. It had nothing to do with actual weather. That's the one thing that I try to stress with people. That has nothing to do with weather. It has to do with politicians being filled with hot air,
it's so understandable to misunderstand that because it's so windy there.
It is. Yeah, so you get that breeze off the lake. Yeah, yes. You could think, oh, well, that's where it came from, but no.
I was just wondering when it started. And I'm sure you've told me this before in one of our many episodes, but you said yes. So William Thompson, he's elected mayor. He served during the most corrupt and violent time of the city. The stats that you shared are crazy. You know, 214 gangsters who slaughter one another dead in 4 years. Gangsters killed by police 160 during the same period. I I didn't. What I meant to do is I meant to look up stats now because I know Chicago can still be real bad, but I don't think
yeah,
it's
no,
this bad.
I don't know. It's not.
I do remember there was an Onion article and just the title of it said like Chicago Air now like 43% bullets or something like that. If you're ever there on the 4th of July or weekend,
And really, I mean, all of that, unlike then, you know, at this time, you know, in the teens and the 1920s, you know, unlike then it was happening all over the city.
Yeah.
You know, at least now we know where
it's contained.
The bad areas are fairly contained. So than they used to be anyway.
So is that why they said this is like the only completely corrupt city or whatever that quote was?
They called it the, you know, that it was the only completely corrupt city in America just because everything just was completely unchecked when Thompson was in office.
That's crazy.
Seriously, it was anything goes. And I talked about how he ran and everywhere he went, he would just tell everybody what they wanted to hear.
Yeah.
I know that sounds familiar, but let's not say anything about that.
Right.
But he would just lie to everybody and just tell them, we're going to do this. Oh,
yeah.
And then, you know, didn't keep any of his promises other than the ones he made to like gangsters and gamblers,
right.
You know, hey, no, wide open, man. You do what anything you want to. So
what?
I don't know what the deal is with this guy. You know what? I always think it's funny. I always refer to the, when he started his political career, that one of his like supporters was quoted as saying, "The worst thing you can say about him is that he's stupid."
Yes,
I mean the dude is dumb. I mean he's really dumb. And there's a couple of books that were written years. I mean I've got one written like in the 50s. It's just phenomenal.
Yeah,
and it's just about what a corrupt, dumb goofball this guy was.
Yeah.
You know, we just promised everybody everything and just let pretty much anything go.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, his first few years, we're going to get to all this later because having him in office is a big part of what makes Chicago's reputation,
right,
and allows it to become Murder City,
yes,
and allows it to become a place that is, you know, pretty much run by the mob. It's because of him, but there's a short period where he loses the election. And when he reruns the first time, he's voted out. And that's when everybody just adjust their businesses to stay running.
Right.
But then when everybody sees that it's harder to get booze, then they just vote him back in. So he's back in office again.
Sense.
Yeah. So it's crazy. It really is a pretty crazy time period in history. And, you know, we make this, you know, podcast that's going to be about Capone and Torrio and O'Banion and everything. But honestly, Big Bill Thompson was just as instrumental in everything that happened, you know, with the corruption and the way that the cops were bought off and the way the city just became this kind of cesspool of violence and booze. I mean, he was definitely a major player.
That's what I'm starting to learn from this episode. Yeah, is that you're bringing in some other people. I mean, because we talked about Big Jim a little bit here in this episode, not as much. But like
not as much because his days are numbered. So
yes. Okay. Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit then too, because that's kind of one of the last things I have on here is Big Jim leaving his wife.
One of the things I really enjoyed to write about was that, you know, here's Torrio, this family man is doing all this stuff. And, you know, he's this businessman and that, you know, he's this skilled business manager for his uncle who then turns around and makes two mistakes.
Yes.
The first one was giving Torrio complete control of his business. And most of that happened because he was distracted. I mean, this is a guy who lucked into his business in the first place.
Yes, right. So he didn't
I don't
earn
think,
it, anything.
No, I don't think he was really this real go-getter. He might have been in the very beginning. He saw a way to make stuff work because no one else was doing it at the time, and kind of worked his way to the top and then had his nephew to make sure he stayed there. But he really just wanted to screw around in that cafe.
That's really
all he wanted to do. He wanted to mess around with his restaurant. Yeah, he's happiest in his restaurant, messing with all that. And so the rest of it is just a distraction to him. He wants to be legit. You know, that's what he wants. And I can't give you the number of gangsters who all, when trying to go legit, end up dead.
Yeah, right.
There's a long list of those. But so his first real mistake was giving Torrio control. And then, of course, his second one was the source of his distraction. And in addition to the restaurant, it was Dale Winter, this girl that he'd heard sing and now had fallen in love with and apparently had fallen in love with him. I can't find anything that says that she didn't, but I find it hard to believe.
Okay, I was curious about that part. But
I just keep thinking that she's playing along with this and, you know, sees a way to make, you know, even though she's singing in a church and claims to be this innocent young woman, it makes me wonder if maybe there's not more to the story that we don't know. Because, you know, you've seen pictures of this guy. If you haven't, you should check it out.
Yeah, no, I've seen
And then take a look at a picture of her.
Okay, yeah. So
yeah, it's not, I'm not buying it. I'm not buying the age difference and the and all that with her. But I mean, she does then try to, you know, clean him up a little bit. I think she was trying to help him go legit. You know, she's trying to get him to calm down. He'd try to stop swearing all the time, perfect his English, dress a little bit better, leave the fucking diamonds at home, you know, instead of dragging him out all the time. And now he just wants to hang around again, wants to just hang around with his customers, all the wealthy people and, you know, and kind of the politicians and the other gangsters that he depended on all these years. Now he's giving them the cold shoulder.
Right.
Again, another good way to end up dead.
It is. You know? Oh, I'm looking up a picture of Dale Winter. Yeah, she's a looker. Iconic for that time. But
sure, absolutely.
I'm seeing. Yeah, like that's. Oh wow, that is awesome.
Yeah.
But we do have some potential little ghost stories here.
We have some ghost stories mixed in at the Four Deuces. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
That became Torrio's headquarters.
Uh huh.
And, you know, it got its name from the address, obviously, the 2222 South Wabash. It's the Four Deuces. So he starts calling it the Four Deuces. They're running a club. They're running a brothel out of there. You know, you can drink, you can gamble. And story goes is that if you have crossed somebody or you're a rival gangster and they need information from you, you do not want to end up in the basement of the Four Deuces because you are liable not to come out of there alive. Kind of like the basement at the Maxwell Street police station years later in the 1960s, 70s, and into the 80s when you had a sergeant there who was torturing people in the basement and then it all came out.
Good Lord.
This is the same kind of deal, except these weren't cops. These
some have badges. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. The gangsters with badges other case. Yeah.
Exactly. Oh my gosh.
But yeah, that's believed to what has, you know, created the ghost stories about the building that were there. And plus, you know, I mean, this was even when it was still standing. And then after it was torn down in the 60s, people were still telling the ghost stories. And, you know, they would say, oh, you know, it's the gangsters, or it could be the woman who filled her bathtub with kerosene, got in and set it on fire. Oh my God. I cannot think of a worse way to commit suicide.
I couldn't when you wrote this, I didn't understand if this was like he fell down an elevator shaft onto some bullets, or is this she really did that thing?
No, she really did that. This
oh
was
my
this
God.
Was no, this was long after. This was in 1932. This was after, you know, Torrio had already abandoned the place when they we'll get to that.
But
when they moved out to Cicero, because they had to switch their operations around, because when Thompson was not in office for one term, they moved a lot of their stuff to Cicero. And so they had kind of abandoned this building and it was turned back into an apartment building. And in 32, when this woman was living there, she had decided to commit suicide, and she did so by filling your bathtub full of kerosene and set it in on fire.
Yeah, I didn't know if there was context there. I was missing out.
Yeah, no. This was a real thing. That's really where how it happened. Now, the guys in the basement, they definitely just fell on some bullets, tripped over something, got beat up.
A banana peel.
Yeah, exactly.
And broke their face.
But no, there was an interview with a guy who had lived in that building. And lived in that apartment that claimed that he would hear these blood-curdling screams coming from the bathroom. And, of course, the place was empty, but he said he smelled burning flesh in the air that he'd served in France during World War I.
Yes.
Knew what death smells like.
Yep, I believe him.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so, man. Well, but this is around – okay, so pretty much where we'd wrap up, I guess, is this is Torrio's – He's seeing the writing on the wall, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Being the organizational mastermind that he is.
He knows what's coming.
Yeah. And so he's starting to get prepped for Prohibition. And and I'm guessing all hell's going to break loose.
Yeah. Calls Capone, says he needs him to come to Chicago because he needs somebody he can trust. And, you know, he'd already tried to convince Big Jim that, you know, with the brothels going and, you know, their days are numbered the way they've got it set up now. Sure, they'll have gambling, but, you know, it's going to be illegal booze. That's going to be the way to go. And Jim's like, I've already been, I've been doing gambling. I'm already rich. I'm not going to risk something new. Well, Torrio knew that the only way to make sure this thing was going to run smooth was to get his uncle out of the way. And things are definitely going to take a turn in our next episode. We're going to see a lot more Capone again.
Yeah.
Because he is now in Chicago. And, well, I mean, somebody had to pull the trigger on Big Jim. I mean, you know, we can never prove who it was, but hey,
right,
somebody's going to
can't you build an empire anymore and then just walk away from it scot-free, you know? It's always gonna regime change or something.
Seems to be that way.
It does seem to be that way. Well, normally this is when I'd pull up our Ghost Rider segment. I don't have any. I had a couple of people that did email to AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com and sent in some nice letters. A couple of them were really long, and they did say, you know, please actually don't read this on air. I appreciate people reaching out.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Well, that's okay, because they all texted me instead.
Yes, exactly.
I have a lot. I don't know if I'll get to all of them here, but I do have a number of them. Several of them are really short, though. So, you will find them enjoyable. So as Cody mentioned, you can email him at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com, or you can text us on the haunt line, which is 217-791-7859. And the first one of them comes from the 724, and it goes back to our conversation, which I've had about six times now since then, about pork steak.
No shit.
Pork steaks that we had, it being a St. Louis thing, and people look at me blankly. They still do. I mean, I was when I was in LA, I was chatting with somebody. We were talking about something, and I mentioned the conversations about pork steak, and no idea what I was talking about.
Really?
So anyway, this person said, and 724 I know is Pennsylvania. They said, I looked up pork steak and it sounds awesome, so I'm going to look for somebody to cut me some, because they don't just, you know, you can't just buy it on the shelf in other places.
I know toasted ravioli, and that's I didn't know that that was a regional thing.
I know, I didn't either. So, all right. So this one comes to us from Karen in the 410, and it's hey, Troy and Cody, just re-listened to the Limp Family episodes and appreciated them way more after listening to them back to back. I didn't care that there was a lack of ghosts until the end, because the history is enough and makes me want to read the book even more. I'm excited for the Capone episodes. I'm not normally a big fan of gangsters and Prohibition history, but if anyone can make me interested in the era, it's you two fellas. Thanks for all that you do. So thank you, Karen.
Thanks, Karen. Nice.
Listen, this one comes from the 509, and it is, let's see. I says, hey, I'm listening to the Big Jim Colosimo episode right now. I'm assuming you've already done some, if not all, of the research for the season. Of the different gangsters you talk about, who would you consider to be the worst of all? Meaning, who would be the most deadly and just downright nasty? And did you use any books for research? Well, my own. And there's a huge bibliography in the back of it. I'd love to read some. If you have a couple, that would be the best and the most inclusive. I will look up that and send you, I'll text you back with a few titles. And then triple sets of 5-star reviews for you guys. As always, keep up the good work. What sucks the most is I'm current with everything. So as far as some of the downright nasty gangsters, we'll get into that.
Okay.
We will get into that because there's going to be an entire episode that's just going to be on how Torrio divides up Chicago during Prohibition. Okay. Because you know how Torrio is. His plan is for everybody to work together and to get along because there's more than enough money for everybody. Not enough to go. There's plenty to go around, and there's no reason for everybody to go to war. Now, you know that's not going to last,
right,
but it's
right.
A great idea.
It looks great.
And I'll
paper.
Talk more about the individual gangsters then, because there's a couple of really dumb and nasty guys are involved.
I'm interested to dive into more of that because as I think a lot of you know, when we talk about killers and things like that, it's the ones that kill indiscriminately or don't have any kind of pattern that freak me out the most. And then sex trafficking and that sort of thing. Like that's the real bad stuff in my opinion. Because anybody's fair game and they don't care what they're doing.
Exactly. Exactly.
I hate that stuff. So
it's easier to be entertained by guys who just want to, you know, give people booze.
And
the law is so stupid anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so but anyway, this one comes to us from Shannon in the 630. She's a regular contributor. Mm-hmm. She said, "Hey, my family and I watched the werewolf episode. That was the History's Greatest Mysteries.
Yeah.
And loved it. It was fascinating. Learned a few things I didn't know, like the werewolf trials. Looking forward to other show appearances. Is there a place to find a list of what you've already been on? I know you've been doing this for a while. Jesus, I don't even know.
I'll make it.
I should probably work on something. I've got a lot of stuff on my IMDb, but it's not complete.
So, right.
But Shannon, if you're listening to this, don't forget to remind your husband to get in touch with me about what we discussed last time you guys were down. He'll know what I'm talking about. It's about the museum. So this one comes to us from the 270. And it says, just want to mention a couple things and pose a question. First, from the last episode, I have to agree with two listeners. I started with the New Orleans season and then went back and started at the beginning until I caught up. That was 5 years ago and I'm still here.
Wow.
I also listened or re-listened to the Dead of Winter episode, even though I was there.
Yes.
Next, I know a Rose and a Josephine. Rose is 29, Josephine 17. They're both under 35. Remember how we were talking about bringing back old names?
Do you think
the reason Jack the Ripper is still talked about so much is because we still don't know who he is? Absolutely.
Yeah.
People are going to talk about unsolved crimes much more. I mean, look at the Black Dahlia story. I mean, listen, don't get me wrong. It's a fascinating story, but it's a single murder that happened in 1947. And we still talk about it because of not only the Hollywood connections, that it's LA, that it was so brutal. And because it's unsolved.
Exactly.
That's the main reason.
Troy. I forget about some of the, not that the Black Dahlia is, I'm saying some of the dumb things you and I talk about, like names of people under a certain age.
Oh, I know.
I forget some of that.
And then says, finally, I love that you've added the extra alternative shows in the lineup. I like to binge multiple episodes at one sitting, maybe because I did that when I first started. And now I don't have to wait very long to do that. So love the show. Please don't ever stop. Well, as we said, you know, as long as you guys keep listening, we will keep doing it. Let's see. This is from the six. This is Ellen in the 618. She said, I just listened to the second episode of the new season. It was really interesting, but you had me at pork steak. Why don't people eat this food? More beyond here is beyond me. So she's from the 618, though. She gets it. That's our area code. Right. She said, I forgot to tell you, I was speaking to you after the dinner at Dead of Winter, and I wanted to thank you for your research. I know you've put years and years into it, and it's cool to hear all the details. Also, a message for Cody. You're amazing. This person is obviously delusional. I'm kidding. And the heartbeat of the podcast. You keep it on track. You ask the questions we all want to know and keep it light. Thank you. So just wanted to share that with you.
Thank you so much.
And then this one is from the 815. And hey, Troy and Cody, just listened to the latest episode of American Hauntings And you said no one is saying much about your other podcast, American Nightmares. I just wanted to say I personally love both podcasts. You know your history and have a great way to deliver the information. I get very excited when I see a new episode of the podcast pop up. So keep up the good work. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Let's see. Did I say that was from the 815? I think I did. Okay, let's see. Okay, this is, there's a lot going on. Oh, okay, here. Now this one is from the 913. And it says, hey, it's Cody from KC. Sorry I missed Dead of Winter this year. Inbound terrible joke. I was enjoying a cheeseburger in paradise. They sent a picture of being on a beach reading my Donner Party book, The Forlorn Hope, with palm trees in the background. Talk about completely different subject. We're reading about pioneers stuck in the snow while on a beach.
I kind of love
but
it.
Anyway, couldn't think of a better time to suffer those fools in 23 feet of snow while sitting on a beach in Belize. And by the way, I should be a strong candidate for podcast listener of the year. I'm a mobile dog groomer, so it often takes two or three listens to fully hear it all. I accept cash or checks for my royalties.
That's oh my great. Gosh.
Love what you do. I'll get to Alton soon. FYI, the book did not come back from Belize. I met a local who loves history, but the library on an island in Central America is limited. So I gladly gifted it to a Belizean in need of a good reading.
Oh, that's so awesome.
That's funny.
That's awesome.
That's really funny. Yeah. And this one comes to us from the, I told you there was a line. This one comes to us from the 360 and it said, good evening. Just want to say I'm a huge fan. Found your podcast listening to another favorite podcast of mine by Bridget Marcourt, the Ghost Bunny. You know,
oh, yeah.
Bridget. Yeah. Yeah, I love Bridget. I was hooked from the very first episode and have been binge listening every chance I get. From whenever I cook for my family, while I'm getting ready for work, while I'm driving in the mountains, or the end of the shift at work, your show is on. I'm currently on season 9, and with each series, my mind is always blown. The Missing Children episodes is hard to listen to, but I could not peel my ears away. Thank you for the entertainment and the goofy banter between you two. Someday I will definitely take time out of my chaotic life and get to Alton and see you guys. Keep up the good work. Love, a faithful listener.
It blows my mind that people listen to our podcast the same way I listen to like some of my
Too. I know. I feel the same way. So, oh my gosh, we still have several more here.
Do you
want to save some for next time?
I think, how about we save some for next time?
Okay, let's save some for next time. And so I do have more, and we will read some more the next time. And yeah. So don't feel like you can't send them, because we've got a stockpile. Right. We still want to hear from you.
So. You know, yeah, I didn't have some things that I wanted to talk about today. So it just from listeners. So it makes
sense. Yeah, it worked out great.
Let's hit up a bunch of hotline stuff, but okay. we'll keep them coming.
Yeah, just don't forget, keep them coming. The hotline is 217-791-7859. All right, man, I'm going to take us out then.
Do it.
Thanks again for checking out the story and the postmortem for this week's episode of American Hauntings, which is part of the American Hauntings, Who Would Have Thought podcast network. We hope you love the show along with the other shows in the network. And if you do, we hope you'll tell other people about them and encourage them to listen. And if you get a chance, leave us a review wherever you listen, which makes it easier for people to find us. As a thank you to our listeners, we also have a discount you can use to get 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store. Just use the word podcast at checkout to save. Alton Hauntings, American Hauntings is more than just this podcast, like the Alton Hauntings tour. Also other tours and books and ghost hunts and events and the Haunted America Conference and, of course, the museum in Alton, Illinois. You can find everything we offer on the website at AmericanHauntings.net.
Beautiful. This episode of
This
episode of the Alton Hauntings. Oh wait.
Yeah, I know.
Of the American Hauntings podcast.
Hey, listen, you know how many times I've had to redo American Nightmares when I go to close it out? Thanks for listening to this episode of American Hauntings. Damn it. And then I got to start over on that whole part again and edit it out.
So. Well, as you just heard, yeah, it's written and narrated by Troy Taylor.
Yeah, badly.
Produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. The last time, I don't know if everybody was in on the joke or what, but I turned away because the me in the document is really, really big. So they wanted me to say it loud. So I turned away and I yelled it.
Well, I didn't. It was a joke because I capitalized it. And then you made a big deal out of the capitalization. So
it's a huge
enlarged. Well, then, yeah, now it is. I enlarged the font to like 24 points. Right. It's huge now.
But I turned, I yelled, and then Zoom cut the audio because the clips
it was too loud.
So Troy's like, did you
just
say
shut
anything?
It off?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't hear a word you said.
Oh, man. Okay, well, to find out more about the show, check out the show notes or go to our website, AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. If you want to find out more about the podcast, you can reach us by email, by text on the hotline, or our Facebook and Instagram, where we're often hanging out. Thanks again for listening. We couldn't and definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
See you later.
All right. Cool. Where am I at?